I'm Krista Tippett. Today, Sustaining Language, Sustaining Meaning, an Ojibwe story. My guest is the novelist and translator David Troyer. He is helping to compile the first practical grammar of the Ojibwe language, one of the 90% of human languages that could be endangered in this century. David Troyer describes an unfolding experience of how language shapes us culturally, spiritually, and in relationship to the world around us. Some memories he has found can only be carried forward in time in Ojibwe.
What I really love about language revitalization and what is so key to it is that it's always been ours. And it's a chance to define ourselves on and in our own terms and in ways that have nothing to do with what's been taken. We can define ourselves by virtue of what we've saved.
This is Speaking of Faith. Stay with us.
This public radio podcast is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness. Online at loveandforgive.org.
I'm Krista Tippett. Language is a carrier of human identity. It is a vehicle by which we understand and express our very sense of self. For most of us, in our mother tongues, this happens unconsciously. My guest, David Troyer, has been compelled to reckon with the meaning which language holds as he strives to keep the tongue of his tribe, the Ojibwe, alive. In writing and in life, David Troyer describes an unfolding awareness of aspects of his personality, of a sense of what brings him joy, an understanding of what makes him human that the Ojibwe language distinctly conveys. From American Public Media, this is Speaking of Faith, public radio's conversation about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. Today, Sustaining Language, Sustaining Meaning, an Ojibwe story.
Sea beans.
When is it done? Kidima, we are not.
A makaki. Giggle and jack.
The world's 6 billion people speak between 6,000 and 7,000 languages. But experts predict that as many as 90% of those languages may cease to be in use by the end of this century. Endangered languages are just one ripple effect of ever more accessible means of travel, communication, and entertainment. But there is a growing field of awareness that something more than speech, more than words, perishes when a language dies. When we lose a language, says David Harrison of the Living Tongues Institute in Oregon, we lose centuries of human thinking about time, seasons, sea creatures, reindeer, edible flowers, mathematics, landscapes, myths, music, the unknown, and the everyday. In a kind of backhanded acknowledgement of this power of language, the eradication of indigenous tongues was once a matter of federal policy in the United States. Today, only about a third to a half of the native languages that were on this continent when Europeans arrived are still spoken, sometimes by a very small number of elders. David Troyer is a novelist, translator, and Ojibwe Indian who's written widely about the complicated role Native Americans play in the American imagination. And he recently began a project with his brother, the linguist Anton Troyer, to compile the first practical Ojibwe grammar. David Troyer teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Minnesota, and he lives part-time on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He grew up there, but did not become fluent in the Ojibwe language until he was an adult. In fact, David Troyer never imagined he would return to the reservation when he followed his brother to Princeton for college.
So in those years, you know, in college, you learn how to talk and think about yourself. So that language seemed to me to be an important part of that. And I should say that my older brother felt this more keenly and more strongly and sooner than I did. And after he left, after he graduated Princeton, he moved directly back home and he devoted himself to learning Ojibwe. And I saw that. I saw him doing that. And I admired it so much. And I wanted to have relationships with these elderly Ojibwe people for whom English was a kind of secondhand clothing that they that they wore in public, but it really didn't define them. It didn't make sense to them, and they didn't express themselves well. And these were sort of these precious people that I wanted to understand, not on my terms, not on my college, Ivy League educated terms. I wanted to understand them in their terms, and I wanted to share them. And really the only way to do that was through the language. And there's another aspect of it too, which is, and this is even more important, I think, for a lot of Native people who are involved in language revitalization efforts, which is that a lot of times over the last 50, 60 years, a lot of Native people define themselves as Native by virtue of what they've lost, you know?
Right.
I'm Native because I'm poor, because because I was quote-unquote forced on a reservation, because I drank powdered milk and grew up in HUD housing, and because I've lost my cousins, because I've struggled with alcohol or whatever. And there's validity in that. There really is. But what I really love about language revitalization and what is so key to it is that it's always been ours. It's never been given to us. It's never, our native languages aren't forced on us. And it's a chance to define ourselves on and in our own terms and in ways that have nothing to do with what's been taken. We can define ourselves by virtue of what we've saved. Yeah.
So when you talk about language revitalization, and I think you're referring to the same thing in a positive way when people talk about endangered languages, rescuing endangered languages.
Right.
But one of the things when scientists do this or anthropologists, one of the things they're trying to figure out is how speech influences thought, whether grammar is innate or learned, and how all of this forms who we are. And I'm curious to hear from your knowledge of, and kind of coming back to Ojibwe and learning it as an adult, how you experience those propositions about how language is about more than speech. One thing you said is that Ojibwe is dominated by verbs.
Yes,
I mean, that
it
intrigues
is.
Me. So what difference does that make?
Well, we're going to talk loose here in ways that I think, who's that linguist from MIT? He wrote The Language Instinct.
Is it Steven Pinker?
Steven Pinker, yeah. So I'm going to talk loose and easy in ways that Steven Pinker would not appreciate, probably.
Okay.
He thinks there's a language instinct. He thinks grammar is hardwired and that no languages contain a special way of knowing something that another language wouldn't contain. And there's some interesting aspects of that argument, but what Ojibwe affords in terms of its how it inflects thought process, like you say, it's two-thirds verbs. It's a very active, fluid language, but it possesses a kind of nuance in terms of how it can create or describe and then pose and reinvestigate actions and relationships between people and things.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that, especially in one's mother tongue, you don't even think about. And I don't even know what the relationship is in terms of what's the percentage of nouns to verbs in English.
I don't know.
Can you give me an example of an idea or a thought which would be transformed or nuanced in a different way if you were saying it in a deep way, by this prevalence of verbs?
Gosh, you asked me a really hard
Okay,
one.
Well, think of it, though.
I can think of, I mean, it's easier. I mean, maybe this is the nature of examples themselves. I can think of it in terms of nouns. There's actually a little children's song that was recorded in the early part of the 19th century by Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, written down, that is. And then was borrowed by Longfellow in The Song of Hiawatha, and it's about fireflies. And there's one line in that song, it's really a children's ditty, sort of like London Bridges, but an Ojibwe equivalent, where the word for fireflies, wawa tesi, it says, wawa tesi, wawa tesi, wawa tese mawishin, is the first line. So a literal translation would be, firefly, firefly, of the first two words in that line. The last word, it changed firefly, wawatisi,
yeah,
into
mm-hmm.
a verb. So you can make something a verb very easily in Ojibwe. So it's basically firefly, firefly, firefly for me.
Hmm. Oh.
So it has like a triple play, both, you know, be yourself for me, and then blink and coast for me, and then just fly for me at the same time. And so there's a kind of wordplay in that little children's ditty, which is really a wonderful example of the kind of magic in the language, where you can make words do so many things at the same time. Now, you can do this with any language. You can make words do double and triple duty, and if you can't, then one shouldn't write. But Ojibwe does it in a way, I think, that is quite special.
Author and translator David Troyer. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith from American Public Media. Today, sustaining language, sustaining meaning, an Ojibwe story. The Ojibwe word that translates in English as namesake is one example David Troyer gives of how his tribe's spiritual culture is distinctly born by its language.
When you're given an Ojibwe name, you have 7, 8, 9 namesakes. You have one person who's running the ceremony, and the others participate in the ceremony. And the word for a namesake, both the person running the ceremony and these other attendants in the ceremony, is niowe'e. And niow is my body. The idea being that when you're giving somebody a name or receiving one, you're partaking in their soul. You're basically gifting somebody a portion of your soul, which will reside then in that other person's body.
And that is something that's a piece of knowledge or a piece of your identity that you carry with you through your life.
Yeah, yeah. All those names, because you can get anywhere from just one to 6 or 7 at that ceremony, which usually occurs ideally when you're quite young. So when you give someone a name, you're giving them part of your soul. And when you accept a name, you're both accepting the soul given and you're giving part of your own. And so you're connected in ways that are sort of profound and meaningful and communicated by the very word, which the English translation namesake doesn't really cover.
No.
And so those are the kinds of understandings which are obvious to Ojibwe speakers.
In your novel, in your most recent novel, the translation of Dr. Apelles, he is described as a different person when he's feeling like a different person when he speaks the language of his tribes and others, that he can joke, he can flirt. And then there's this very evocative way, as you say, these languages lend themselves to memory. Explain that to me.
Well, myths and ideas about Indian people often obscure the true dimensions of our lives. And that's very much the case for Dr. Apelles. He's kind of shy and not very stoic and a little pudgy and super smart but not very personable and lives in a city and works as a librarian of sorts at a very strange library. His life does not conform to any of the ideas that most people have about Indian lives. And part of the reason is that those ideas are ideas that people have in, at least in the context of America, in English. So English is almost the language that we have for storytelling about Indians is almost his enemy, or it's certainly not helping him express his truest self. And it's these other native languages which he both had as a child and acquired as someone studying linguistics that he feels more comfortable in, because he doesn't have to do combat in those languages with the trove of notions and icons and images and ideas that attend Indians in English. In these native languages, he's sort of unburdened of all of those things. And he is, he becomes sort of newly made in them. And it's easier for him to more accurately remember his past. Because the danger is for native people too, and also for the, my character, that we're as likely to misconstrue ourselves, perhaps, in English.
And that does speak to this idea that a language carries more than words. I mean, I think what you're saying also is that while English can tell some of the narrative and the story of what happened to Native people, certain memories are only going to be kept alive in that those tongues.
That's true. And in the Ojibwe context, two other things are kept alive in those tongues, two very important things. One is ceremonial life. Ojibwe ceremonies are very rigidly enforced. And this runs counter to the idea of Native spirituality as kind of a emotional and spiritual free-for-all where you just have to feel it. You can just feel it and just be it and do it. And Ojibwe ceremonies run counter to that notion where they're really tightly controlled in some ways. And orthodoxy plays a big part in those ceremonies, which really doesn't jive with the
idea.
Give
me an example of what orthodoxy would be in a ceremony.
Two examples. Like one, in certain Ojibwe ceremonies, you cannot do the ceremonies in any other language than Ojibwe. And two, you cannot use any kind of modern form of technology to preserve them. And you can't talk about them either outside of the ceremony. But so we can talk about the reasons and rationale, and that the substance of the ceremony itself is largely concerned with this idea of transmission and of human to human and spirit to human transmission of knowledge, healing, as communicated through legends and songs and procedures. So the ceremonies can't be done in any other language. They can't be written down. They can't be recorded. You can't videotape them. And so if the language goes, those ceremonies, which are central to who we are, they go.
This is a live recording of the Leech Lake Intertribal Singers performing at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds in Bemidji, Minnesota.
In fact, there was an old man named Archie Mose. Archie was born in 1901. He started his ceremonial commitments when he was 14, in 1914, which he continued to his death in 1996. And Archie was running one of these ceremonies, and my brother saw this, where Archie was very frustrated that people weren't understanding what was supposed to be done in the ceremony. And he was frustrated with the level of their commitment. And he was very uncharacteristically frustrated because he was a very gentle, mellow, kind guy. And so he left the ceremonial enclosure, sort of a wigwam of sorts. And he got up from his place in the wigwam and he walked outside and stood there. And he says, in English, he said, "I had to come out here because I can't use English in there. And I can't use English in there because the spirit does not understand me when I speak English. But I want you to understand me, and that's why I'm speaking English." And then he started to sort of yell at people in English. And so there's that. But there's also this issue of, and this is a political issue too, around language, of our sovereignty, of our
Ojibwe tribal sovereignty.
Tribal sovereignty. And Red Lake Reservation, the Red Lake Nation knows this so well. For example, they were going to have a negotiation with the state of Minnesota over some water rights. And they asked my brother to come up and interpret. And so they've done this on a number of occasions. And what happened was they delivered their testimony in Ojibwe. My brother translated for the representatives from Minnesota. Now, all of the people speaking Ojibwe also spoke English very, very well. And so someone asked them, "Why do you bother?" And they said, "Well, it's really important for them to remember who we are. They tend to forget that. Well, this is a different nation. We have a different language." this is just a reminder.
You know, the statistics are pretty daunting, and generally in terms of languages disappearing. Some have said that half to 90% of the languages now spoken on Earth might disappear in this century. And on this continent, on this continent, there were something like 300 tribal languages at first contact with Europeans. And now only, I think you wrote this, only about 100 are left. Only a handful will remain by the end of this century. Ojibwe will be one of those.
It will be.
Is there something in Ojibwe culture or language that has made it more tenacious?
I don't think there's anything. I wouldn't privilege the language in terms of something special about it that has ensured its survival. But there are a couple factors. In fact, it's such a complicated language. And it was, by the way, in the Guinness Book of World Records as being the most difficult language to learn. Now, I don't know how do they decide. Your job is to learn every language and tell us which one was hardest. But so I think there actually is a vote against it. It's a difficult, complicated language. A given verb can have 4,000 different forms by the time you're done monkeying around with it. And that's not an exaggeration. That's someone did a count, and so it's actually a difficult, difficult language to come to as a second language learner, which makes its survival a little more precarious than a language that might be easier. I don't know what languages might be easy. All languages are both easy and hard. We all acquire them, and they're all difficult at a certain age. But I think what Ojibwe had in its favor mostly was geography. That until very recently, our communities in the northern United States, in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan, but particularly in Ontario and Manitoba, were incredibly hard to get to.
Really? You think that's part of the explanation?
A big part of it.
Because
absolutely.
It was isolated.
The isolation helps. And there are reserves in Canada that you can only get to by float plane. Ojibwe reserves that aren't accessible by road. There are no roads still to this day. And everyone from the smallest child to the oldest adult speaks Ojibwe. And it's because these places are remote, it helps. Contact with work and schools and churches and things like that and popular culture and all the kind of migrations that occur when you have a good highway system, right?
Which all is those things dangerous for languages, I guess.
It's dangerous for languages. So is satellite TV, which is very widely used on these remote reserves now, by the way. Everyone watches Discovery Channel and Spike. Spike TV. And so the geography helps. And the ceremonies help, too. This idea that language and spirituality were so closely related, they couldn't be separated. And for those Ojibwe people who remained traditional, who didn't want to convert to Christianity, language then became something that they also held on to.
Author and translator David Troyer. Here are some sounds of a classroom in northern Minnesota where students are taught exclusively in Ojibwe. This is Speaking of Faith. After a short break, more conversation with author and translator David Troyer and stories from his Ojibwe grammar project. Also, where U.S. culture once sought to unify language as a way to build civilization, David Troyer says that the flourishing of civilization in this century may depend upon a capacity to live graciously with differences that languages keep vital.
Nishtana.
Listen to recordings of several Ojibwe speakers at our website, speakingoffaith.org. And check out our blog, SOF Observed, where we involve you in the production process. This week, read about the evolution of this program from a vague idea in a staff meeting all the way to the final mix you're hearing today. Look for links to SOF Observed and much more at speakingoffaith.org. I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us. Speaking of Faith comes to you from American Public Media.
Speaking of Faith is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of the Splendid Tables How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now wherever books are sold. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. Public radio listeners are talking at Gather.com.
Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, Public Radio's conversation about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. I'm Krista Tippett. Today, Sustaining Language, Sustaining Meaning, an Ojibwe story. We're exploring the perspective and stories of novelist and translator David Troyer. His work offers a window into the world of his native tribe, the Ojibwe, and also illuminates the layers of knowledge, culture, and identity that language can hold. The Ojibwe language is spoken today by about 50,000 people, concentrated around the Great Lakes region of the U.S. and in Ontario and Manitoba in Canada. David Troyer grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, but he's only become fluent in the Ojibwe language as an adult, and he has become part of a larger movement to make it a vital part of the life and education of the next generation. So you and your brother Anton have initiated this project to record, transcribe, and translate Ojibwe speech to compile the first practical Ojibwe language grammar. I mean, tell me how you're going about that.
Slowly. The way we're going about it is we're trying to capture as many different kinds of speech as we can.
And to do that, you are speaking with elderly,
yeah. Ojibwe elders from Wisconsin in Minnesota and Ontario, mostly.
And you're kind of deciphering how the language works from hearing them speak it?
Yeah. I mean, we try to, and my brother's a lot better at this than I am because he's a lot more fluent, but you try to maneuver the conversation into not often traveled grammatical trails.
Gosh, that's interesting.
So you try to maneuver it, and instead of saying like, oh, this is what happened to me. So you have a first-person past tense story. When I was a kid, I went to the store. Then I saw him. So you have first to third person. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then he ran into this other guy, which brings you to a weird Ojibwe verb form, which is third person to fourth person. We have a fourth person.
What's the fourth person?
Well, fourth person is he said to him. So someone who's removed from the action of the story but involved. So it's another remove in time or action. Huh. And so those are very few, but, you know, as opposed to, well, what we said to you all was different than what they said to me. And so you have, you know, second person plural to first person and then third person plural to first person. And then you have sort of dubiative actions. Might have gone, should have, you know, they might have come but didn't. There's a whole special tense for something that was going to happen but never did. And
do we have that in English?
I don't know that we have it in the same kind of, with the same kind of precision that
right.
we have it in Ojibwe.
Right, and that sounds different.
So like I was going to, it's like I'm going, Nindija. I went, Ningi Ija. I was going to go, Ningi Ija, Ningi Ija Ban. I was going to go but didn't, Ningi Ija Si Na Ban. And it's still one word. It's still, like, what I spoke was not a sentence but just a word, which is sort of created all of these different parts. And so the trick is to gather as many different examples of our grammar in as they occur naturally in conversation and from as many different places and dialects as we can. And to then we collect them, we record them basically, and then transcribe, write them down, then translate into English.
I'm curious, as you embarked on this adventure of speaking with people and listening to them, what have you discovered that you never expected that has really broadened your imagination about this word Indian, for example? And maybe, you know, give me some a story or a particular people.
Yeah, there are these two guys who are first cousins that we're recording from. They're from a small village on the Red Lake Reservation called Panima, which is a very remote village, and it held on to language and to traditional customs in ways that other villages and other communities in the region had difficulty hanging on to. But there are these two cousins, one guy named Tom Stillday, everyone calls him Tommy J, and his cousin Eugene Stillday. And they're very different in terms of personality and outlook and so on. But we've been recording them both, and we went to Tommy J's house, and he's also my daughter's namesake, by the way. His cousin Eugene was telling a story about when he was a kid and his family was laid low by the flu. His parents, siblings, everyone but him in this small shack in the village of Panima, dead of winter, snow's deep. And he described sitting by the wood stove. He couldn't get the lantern going. His fingers were too cold and he was too scared. And he couldn't get the kerosene lantern going. He must have been 8 or 9 years old. Everyone's unconscious on the floor. And people knew about the flu. People died from it back then, especially Native people.
Right.
This would have been probably in the 30s. And he described sitting by the stove, which had a little grate on it, and that the only light in the cabin was coming from the grate. And he describes the way the flames were flickering in and out, and he sat there sort of holding on to that light as the one thing that was keeping him from freaking out, and that it would light up in flashes, his family, none of whom were moving on the floor, and that all of a sudden in comes Tommy J's father, Eugene's uncle, who came in and then just took Eugene and walked him through the snow back to his house. Gave him some bread. He hadn't eaten in 3 days, he said, and some water. And then he went back to Eugene's family and stayed with them, kept the fire going, and got them healthy again. And none of them passed away. None of them died. And I don't know that what was special about it was just this sense of family and kinship. Now, it didn't have anything necessarily to do with Ojibwe. But the telling of it in Ojibwe just was very meaningful to me. I don't know how to explain it, but it was like the memory of both that terror and that salvation was kept alive in equal measures. So, you know, in Ojibwe, in a way that was so beautifully drawn by Eugene, who's such an amazingly beautiful speaker of the language, and it gave me a glimpse of what life was like, how hard it was, but how close families were and still are, of course, too. It gave me a picture of a time that I'll never experience.
Right.
And a portrait of a kind of poverty, a kind of vulnerability that goes with a kind of poverty that I'll also, I've never experienced.
This is taken from the recording David and Anton Troyer made of Eugene Stilday telling his story. You know, something I was thinking about as I was reading you, and it's occurring to me again as I'm hearing you speak, is another program we're working on, looking into the legacy of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. He is very important to him, this teaching from the Talmud that words create worlds. And I hear that in the story you just told, and even as you're telling it, you're grasping for the words to describe what it was,
right.
And yet it comes through.
Right.
It's kind of, it's mysterious.
The same, you know, the same, the idea that words give life, you know, I guess is also something you find in Ojibwe culture. In one part of the creation story, you know, we were made out of fairly inert materials, and we had no life until touched by sort of breath of the Creator. We were blown on, and then came to life. And this link, of course, between language and breath, speech and breath, is very much alive in how those ceremonies, Ojibwe ceremonies, continue. Ojibwe ceremonies are based around sort of two things, mostly either legend telling, one thing, storytelling, but a very particular kind, and also song. And there's very much a sense that the song is when being sung in as part of a ceremony, is going right from both the vessel of the drum being used and into the singer, or through the singer, and then directly into the body of the person receiving the song. And the words are, and of course the tune, one would hope. But the words are communicating and giving that person life, as we were given life originally.
Author and translator David Troyer. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith from American Public Media. Today, sustaining language, sustaining meaning, an Ojibwe story. You once wrote that if your language was lost, if Ojibwe were lost, we will lose beauty.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? What is in your mind when you say that, in your heart?
Well, like that story I was talking about that Eugene shared with us is one example of that. And, you know, maybe I could draw on a different tradition, which would be a French literary tradition to come to explain it better. But but Marcel Proust said that, particularly speaking of writing novels, said that nothing really exists in and of itself in a book. That characters and situations and places only take on life by way of contrast. That's how novels build themselves, or through creating contrasts and intentions, resolutions and more contrasts and tensions. And I think the same could be said for life, that nothing exists in and of itself. Everything exists only by way of contrast. So in and of itself, I think Ojibwe is beautiful, just the animal sound of the language, how it flows, to the kinds of trickery that the words themselves can rig up, like the example of the firefly I gave you. But also in contrast to the English with which we are surrounded, Ojibwe seems all the more precious, you know, all the more beautiful.
I think you might look at at the narrowing down of the number of languages in the world as kind of a natural process? It would be possible to say that that's even progress, right? That it comes with technology and with a more unified world. I could imagine someone making that case and then asking, right? You know, and then saying, you know, the question would be, but I think you were just giving an answer to that question. Now, why really, although it might be tragic to you, it might be tragic to people you know, why should this ultimately matter to people who don't speak this language and know nothing of it and whose identity is not formed by it?
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, great advances in communication, for instance, maybe brought the world closer together, and this might be a cynic's point of view, but it brought us close enough to really hurt each other in things like the First World War, the Second World War, more recent endeavors. It hasn't led to a sort of, you know, a great love-in and mutual understanding. Now there is, of course, progress in some ways, naturally. But language, if all languages were to die out and be replaced with one, and there were movements and sort of utopian movements along these lines, Esperanto, I think,
yes,
was one of them,
Esperanto.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That the idea was that if we all spoke the same language, there'd be no misunderstanding. And I don't think that's true. And in fact, I don't think misunderstanding is the culprit here. I think the culprit in terms of conflict, you know, deadly or otherwise, is the sense that you know, we should all be doing the same thing. And I think that we're quite happily, busily doing different things, and that is, in fact, healthy.
And so the culprit is an inability to live creatively with difference.
Perhaps so, yeah.
You know, you wrote an article in the LA Times, and you tell a story in there. You describe a moment of kind of epiphany.
Yeah.
You were spearing with friends on a lake in their treaty area. And, I mean, I do, first of all, want you to talk about what it meant that you were spearing and how does that activity figure in? What in itself does it mean?
Well, I was spending time with two friends from Le Coudre Reservation in north central Wisconsin. And on Le Coudre and in that region, they fought for, in fact, starting in the 70s and concluding recently, fought for and retained their off-reservation treaty rights, many of them. One of those treaty rights is the right to harvest fish, particularly walleye pike, with using quote-unquote primitive methods, that is to say spears and nets, and to do this before the state season opens, the state angling season. Now, this all the spearing and netting is very tightly controlled by the tribe and monitored, and you know, people tend to guard this right and to use it wisely. So although I'm Ojibwe and I'm from a different band, from a different region, and my band was did not sign that particular treaty, so I cannot spear fish in that particular area. So I was just hanging out.
Okay.
Basically, I was drinking coffee, they're
right.
Spearing. And so, you know, for them, it's many things at once. They're practicing a treaty right which was denied them for many, many years. And so it's a political act to go out and to go to the boat landings and offload their boats and to go spearing on lakes ringed with the resort homes of wealthy Americans in northern Wisconsin. And to be heckled and shouted at and have things thrown off docks at them. These things have happened. It happens. It happens with some regularity, and people shouting things. My favorite epithet shouted at sort of Ojibwe people spearfishing in their treaty areas. Indians go home, which I just think is so funny.
Yeah.
And in any event, so it's political, spiritually too. Whenever an Ojibwe person takes something, this is one of our few instructions, is to. You know, always, at least in our cosmology, honor the other beings. The fact of the matter is that those fish were here a long time before we were, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, humans evolved many millions of years after these fish did. So the fish are our elders in a sense, and respect is owed them as elders. in a way. And so you harvest the fish, you kill them with spears is probably the best way to put them, or you trap them in nets, which also kills them. You fillet them. And then the first bunch you eat for the season, you'll have a feast and a small ceremony, usually just a family thing, where you'll give thanks to and for the fish. But it's a way of becoming closer to them.
That's so interesting. I mean, it's counterintuitive.
It is counterintuitive. And so there's a sense that, you know, you can become closer, if you want to put it another way, by killing. And there's actually another Ojibwe idea about that, where when people have lost a loved one and they go into mourning, they go into an official mourning, and it's only a veteran who can bring them out of their official mourning.
It's only a what? A veteran?
A veteran, someone who's been to war. The idea being that since they've taken life, the phrase that people use is in Ojibwe is to touch blood. Huh. That only those who have touched blood can wash away someone's sorrow because they are so intimately related to it, right? Huh. And with the fish, it's a similar kind of relationship, that to really know them, you become related by the taking and the giving. Because then the fish is dispersed to people who don't fish. And it's also a chance for one's ancestors to come back and to eat the food that they would have eaten in their lifetime, to feed them. And so this is done for fish. It's done for the first batch of maple syrup. It's done for first kills in the fall, you know, in terms of, you know, animals that one might shoot, deer, ducks, rabbits, things like that. And it's done particularly for wild rice, which is our biggest food and probably our most important food.
Moment of epiphany. You're drinking coffee while your friends are spearing.
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, we're in the boat. It's dark. It's foggy. And we're just chatting and speaking Ojibwe and also speaking English, too, sort of diving back and forth between the two. And these are two guys who've been instrumental with a group of other people in starting an immersion school on that reservation, which is an Ojibwe language immersion school, which has had fantastic success. I mean, these two guys and their families and the people they work with, and there's a big long list of them, have done amazing and important work. And so it's just, I admire them both a lot, and they're both really funny too, and so we're having a good time. And you do your spearing really close to shore in the shallow water, so we're maybe 15, 20 feet from shore. Most of the houses are boarded up. It's April, and the vacationers haven't come back to their cabins yet. But a few of them are occupied year-round, and somebody must have had their window open. I can see lights flickering in the house, that sort of eerie blue glow of someone's television. And I can hear the program they're watching, and they're watching David Letterman. And the top 10 list was on, the top 10 countdown. And it just seemed so out of place and so impermanent and so weak, thin, and just passing as the fog that night, that compared to how permanent the endeavor of spearing with these guys felt. You know, this is something we've been doing for so long and still doing, and still doing with and in the language, and still respecting the fish the way that they're supposed to be respected. That felt permanent in comparison. That felt everlasting. And I felt our language can't possibly die, not with people like this, not while doing something like this in this place. We can't possibly lose it. And I don't always feel that way, but I felt it then. And I feel that more often than I feel scared that we're going to lose it.
David Troyer is a novelist, essayist, and translator. His books include The Translation of Dr. Apelles and Native American Fiction, A User's Manual. He divides his time between the Leech Lake Reservation and the University of Minnesota, where he is an associate professor of literature and creative writing. In closing, here is one of the friends with whom David Troyer was spearing that day, Keller Papp, singing a song about snaring rabbits with the students at his Ojibwe immersion school. The school has been in operation for 6 years now, and all the children in the program have passed fifth grade aptitude tests mandated by the state of Wisconsin. 66% of them also scored in the top 10 percentiles in English and math. David Troyer and I had a wide-ranging conversation about his life and work, and one part of that conversation that didn't make it into this program was the fascinating story of David's father, an Austrian Jew who fled the Holocaust and ended up on the Leech Lake Reservation where he met David's mother. Hear David Troyer tell that story in our complete, unedited interview or download a free MP3 of this program at speakingoffaith.org. The senior producer of Speaking of Faith is Mitch Hanley, with producers Colleen Scheck, Shiraz Janjua, and Rob McGinley Myers, and with help from Alda Balthrop Lewis. Our online editor is Trent Gillis, with web producer Andrew Dayton. Special thanks this week to Anton Troyer, Keller Papp, and Tom Robertson. Kate Moose is the managing producer of Speaking of Faith, and I'm Krista Tippett.
Speaking of Faith is supported by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and the George Family Foundation, funding innovative ideas in integrative medicine, education, and spirituality in everyday life. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com. Speaking of Faith is extending its reach throughout America with support from Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private foundation.
Next week, a bracing perspective on death and danger, miracle and community, with Maine Game Warden Chaplain Kate Braestrup. Please join us for the next Speaking of Faith.
American Public Media.